Hi, podcast listeners. It's Chris Boyd. On KERA Radio, we're busy hosting our winter membership campaign. It's one of the few times each year when we ask listeners to support the programming that KERA provides by making financial contributions to the station. Well, we've decided to experiment with cutting those pitch breaks from the podcast. You won't hear the phone number and wonder if anyone is actually standing by at that very moment to take your call. But we would still really appreciate it if you are able to contribute. Your donation goes to support all the programming you hear on KERA, including our streaming service. And most importantly, it pays for this podcast so that you can listen to Think wherever you are in the world, whenever you are in time. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. It only takes a minute. In fact, you could do it while listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to Think. Here's today's show.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do you think about what you eat? Many of us consider flavor, nutrient content, and affordability when we choose what we consume. But my guest today believes food deserves to be considered as a philosophical subject in its own right, given its universal importance in human culture and the many philosophical questions raised by the ways that we define, produce, prepare, and consume our food. David M. Kaplan is director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas. He'll be speaking tonight as part of the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology lecture series. He'll be discussing the arguments for and against artificial ingredients in food at that talk. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. What is the purpose of having a philosophy of food?
Well, food is not just a practical matter. It's not just the kind of thing that provides nutrient and sustenance for us, but it's also a matter of taste. It's a matter of pleasure. It's an occasion for people to celebrate and to share and to enjoy one another. But it's also an economic matter. It's also a political matter. It's also a legal matter. So there's many dimensions to food and agriculture, and each one of these has a philosophical component. Namely, because it's a human endeavor, it raises questions about appropriateness, about what kinds of things humans can and should do.
So many of those things, if not most of them, have been true since we've had philosophy. What sort of history has there been of philosophers looking at food?
Very long history. Plato waxes eloquent about food. Right at the start of the second book of the Republic, he distinguishes between what an appropriate diet is for us and what an indulgent or overly luxurious diet is. The Roman Stoics continued that line. They made a strong connection between kind of appropriate conduct and appropriate diet, what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat, when we should eat, and so on. Marx had some very interesting things to say about the role of capitalism as it transformed agricultural practices and transformation to industrial societies. So philosophers have had a long history of addressing themselves to philosophical dimensions of food, but it's probably only in the second part of the 20th century where animal ethics really kind of took off. And so it started all of us thinking anew about the appropriate things to eat and the appropriate ways to raise our food.
Are there things about food that make it particularly challenging as a subject of philosophical inquiry?
I think so, because it is so many different things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sometimes it's a plant, sometimes it's an animal, sometimes it's something that's manufactured in a factory. It undergoes very transformations and it changes and becomes different things along the way. It means something different to different people. It takes on different meanings depending on its context. And it also is something that can be considered simultaneously from different disciplinary perspectives. It can be understood as a commodity. It can be understood as serving some sort of, you know, sacramental function. It can be understood as a matter of identity and social organization and all kinds of different things.
So the same, say, crop of soybeans means a different thing, even philosophically, to the farmer that grows it than to the family that sits down with it at the dinner table.
Well, sure, because for one, it's bread and butter, and mm-hmm. for the other, it's a meal. So I think that's part of the challenge in thinking about food, is really to ask, from what perspective are we talking about? From the perspective of the producer, you know, whether it be the farmer or the manufacturer, are we talking about it as a commodity to be distributed? Are we talking about it as something to be consumed? And above all, one thing that's hard is for us to kind of step outside of our, you know, somewhat privileged Western advanced industrialized perspective and understand things from a more global perspective, understand things from the perspective of a farmer in the exploited South, understand things from the perspective of someone who for whom food means something very different than it means for us.
Is it a sort of a luxury to be able to, if not have a philosophy of food, act on one's philosophy of food?
Well, I'm not sure everyone has a philosophy of food. I mean, to the extent that implicitly we act on reasons. So I guess we could say we all have a philosophy of food, albeit inarticulate, when we eat what we please, for example. Mm-hmm. So that assumes that there's nothing wrong with eating an animal. There's nothing wrong with being unbound and unconstrained in one's choices and simply basing one's choices on one's own desires or hungers or needs or other such things.
So let's step back here for a minute and talk about what counts as food, which sounds like the most ridiculously simple question until you spend even a minute trying to unpack that.
Yeah, what counts as food? I don't know. It's sometimes it's an animal. Sometimes it's an insect. Sometimes it's an ingredient. Sometimes it's decoration. Garnish, for example, is food, but it's not the kind of thing you eat. Drinks. I don't really talk much about drinks in my work, but I don't really know what to make of that. I suppose when you talk about food, we talk about anything that could be consumed, so that would include, you know, beverages and water and spirits and so on. But it seems a little bit odd to say something like, you know, ice is food, or, you know, vitamin C is food, although that's certainly a component in food. So I don't really have a good answer for that. One thing I try to do in my website is to lay out some very different conceptions of what we commonly understand as food, just to kind of put it out there and to help people think through their different conceptions of food to see which one they're implicitly relying on. Very often we understand food in terms of nutrients. Sometimes we understand it as the kind of thing that provides energy. Sometimes we understand it as part of nature. Sometimes we understand it as part of culture and so on. And we're a little bit confused in the way we think through these things. And that's one thing that a philosophy can do, is just help us analyze and organize and clarify our thinking, just so that we can all have a better understanding of where we stand on things and participate in discussions in a way with a little bit more intelligence than we might otherwise do.
Even the idea that the same matter might go from being not seen as food to having been harvested and prepared and cooked in some way, and then it becomes food, and then, say, it goes bad. And so we no longer think of it as food, even though we're talking about the same object.
Food rots.
Yeah.
It spoils.
So what is it then?
It becomes garbage. Right. There was a whole Seinfeld about that, right? You know, George picked up the eclair when it was down
in the garbage can.
In the garbage can, exactly. And so magically, the same thing became transformed from something edible to something vile and disgusting. Yeah, I know it's kind of magical. I don't know if there's really a good answer for that. You know, probably with spoilage, there's maybe some natural biological limits to what anyone can ingest. So sour milk, I guess, is the kind of thing that we can all probably agree on is, if not food, at very least it turns from something edible to inedible. But beyond that, I mean, it gets kind of fuzzy. You know, stale bread, I don't know about that.
Well, I was even thinking about, you know, at the holidays sometimes there are chefs that create these gorgeous gingerbread houses, and they're really intended for display from the moment they are baked and put together. They're made of food, but it's hard to say that they are food, which is a strange state to be in.
Yeah. What would you say about that? It's an artwork that is potentially edible, but typically not eaten. So what does one do with a gingerbread house? Do you eat it afterwards, or do you just display it?
My kids would assume, would insist that you should eat it even if it's incredibly stale. Yeah. But I think most adults would say it's just for display. It gathers dust, it gets dirty, and it looks pretty.
Yeah, like the garnish on your plate, it's, you know, you can eat it if it's on your plate. I suppose it's edible. You know, an ice sculpture, I guess at a wedding, that's probably not the thing that you'd want to break off little pieces and put into your drink. So for something like that, that's a tricky one.
Is it possible, David, to arrive at universal truths about the nature of food, given how deeply tied it is to culture and how differently cultures around the world approach eating and food?
Maybe. I mean, look, that's one thing we're trying to uncover in this discussion here, is the very different meanings of food. Mm-hmm. So it suddenly becomes something different if we stick it together with frosting and make a house out of it and decorate it. So, I mean, food and meaning are always bound up together. It's hard to arrive at something that we could just kind of uncontroversially call food that everyone in the world would agree on and understand as food apart from any kind of meaning. So in other words, you know, is milk, you know, it seems simple enough, but is that children's food? Is that something to be shunned because I'm lactose intolerant? Is it the kind of thing that I think about as going with some foods and not others? For example, do I keep kosher, am I halal, or so on? So it seems unlikely that there could be anything that we could uncontroversially agree on as food in the same way. And I suppose, you know, the only way we could do that is actually ask everyone that when they see this item, what it is, how it is that they're conceiving it. But surely when we talk about food in terms of the kind of thing that provides nutrients and sustenance, when we already understand it in, let's say, a scientific or biological model, then that already strips away a good deal of its meaning.
David M. Kaplan is with us. He's director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas, and he'll be speaking tonight at UT Dallas at the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology lecture series about the arguments for and against artificial ingredients in food. If you'd like to talk about food philosophy or you have a question, join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest will be lecturing tonight for the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology on the arguments for and against artificial ingredients in food. David M. Kaplan is director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Talking just a little bit more before we move on about the nature of food, I was also thinking about things that certain people are allergic to. So for me, a handful of peanuts is for food. For someone else, it could literally be poison.
Right. And, you know, that's a metaphysical question. I mean, people do metaphysics all the time without really being aware of it. And perhaps even if they are aware of it, they wouldn't use that term to describe it. But anytime you try to make sense about the nature of something, what something is, that's what philosophers call metaphysics. So the same thing can be at the same time food in one context or for one person or poison or something to be reviled in another context. And that's what's tricky about coming up with an essence of food, because it seems to me that it is always bound up with meanings. And probably the reason why it's bound up with meanings is because it's a human creation. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that just sort of exists in the world unproblematically. I mean, it has to be the kind of thing that turns into food when we decide to eat it. So something kind of, you know, remarkable happens in that transformation. And I have no idea what that magical moment is when it's, you know, one moment it's a fish swimming happily, you know, in a river, and the next moment it's food when it's on your plate and about to be eaten. So, you know, even for people who work in this area, it's not exactly clear when something becomes food, when it makes this transformation between, you know, being an animal living an autonomous life and, you know, being lunch for someone, or when it's a plant and when it becomes the kind of thing that's bound for one's stomach, or like we said earlier, when it's food and when it's garbage. It's not clear when that happens, but but these changes do happen, and when we try to make sense of them, we're doing metaphysics.
And there are also amazing rabbit trails. I probably shouldn't use that metaphor. There are paths you can go down with regard to the, you know, the production of food and using animals as food, and there are sort of different schools of thought as to whether it's ever appropriate to eat some kind of living creature, or whether it becomes appropriate when we have treated that creature ethically and humanely, and whether it's ever humane to raise an animal to be eaten.
Yeah, what do you think?
You know, they're very challenging questions. And it's easy, again, I think, if you are in a situation in which you have access to whatever kind of food you choose to eat. I feel like the stakes are very different for people who are living very much hand to mouth and maybe wouldn't have food on the table unless they were to find an animal going by. And in that case, it seems like a very obvious choice. And it may be less fraught than it would be for someone who is buying, say, factory farmed meat in the grocery store.
Right. So we have the luxury of those choices. We have, you know, great abundance of food in this country that's tremendously inexpensive. So we can choose whether or not to get our protein from animal or some kind of you know, vegetable source, or perhaps even insect source. But that's right. For some people in the world, animal protein is their only source of protein. And so I think it would be unfair for us to condemn meat eating as cruel, as unjust, as forbidden. However, when we do have choices, then that is something that we have to ask, because animals deserve moral consideration. And I think anyone who would deny that animals deserve moral consideration is kind of out of bounds morally and psychologically. So I think it's pretty non-controversial to say that, you know, a dog or a cat or a house pet, you know, deserves moral treatment, meaning, you know, you shouldn't be cruel to it, you shouldn't torture it, you shouldn't harm it for no good reason. And so, you know, in the same way that you'd say that the animal deserves moral consideration, you would have to apply that to the kind of animals that we eat.
And then, of course, we have to feed those animals. Have you ever, like, I was thinking about this, have you ever had a vegan friend with a house cat? Like, that cat is not going to survive on a vegetarian diet. So there are interesting questions about whether it becomes sort of, it crosses a moral boundary to bring an animal into your home that needs other animals to be killed to survive.
Yeah, it's also a nice thing to bring an animal into your home.
Sure,
and
yeah.
To help, you know, reduce the suffering of that animal, and to help give that animal a good life, and, you know, maybe even give you a good life.
I'm making no judgments. It's just an interesting thing to think about.
Of course. I was hoping you weren't saying that, you know, the vegan is committed to feeding its cat a vegan diet, because, you know, morality is a human affair. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the cats can get together and discuss what appropriate cat behavior is. But I don't know if we're allowed to participate in those discussions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Larry in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Well, you actually just touched on the topic that I wanted to bring up. You talked a little early about, you know, do people really have philosophies of food? And I remember being very struck by a young and passionate vegan friend of mine. When he came back from Central America, you know, he had spent a lot of time explaining to me why it was just absolutely unethical to eat meat. But he came back and he said, you know, I look at these people and they're struggling to stay alive. And he said, I can't look at this guy and say, don't eat that chicken. So you really kind of went down that path that says the morality of food has a lot to do with a choice. And that was just my comment. I'd be interested to hear what you think.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, it makes it hard, doesn't it? I mean, it'd be a lot easier just to say that some things are absolutely right and some things are absolutely wrong. And we could probably do that with people. We can say that we should always respect one another and without exception. But with the animals, it's trickier. And it's probably a mistake to think that there's a kind of general law that applies to each person in every circumstance, the way that we'd be tempted to say that there might be such a law that applies to human behavior.
What kinds of philosophical questions interest you with regard to food we eat that is outside our basic need for nutrition, right? So let's just assume we need three meals a day, and, you know, people can argue that one way or another. But, you know, if somebody brings a plate of chocolate chip cookies to the office, you don't actually need it. You're sort of eating it for entertainment purposes. And is it still food in that case?
It's dessert.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I
so
mean, that's...
it goes beyond its utilitarian function.
Yeah, sure, sure. I would hope so. I mean... You know, I mean, imagine a human diet that only provides, you know, the barest minimum sustenance. You know, that's the stuff of science fiction where, you know, humans eat some kind of ration, some kind of, you know, equivalent of, like, you know, dog chow or kitty chow. There's human chow.
Soylent Green.
Yeah, exactly. Soylent Green. So that's part of what we do with food, and I imagine that's part what people have probably always done. So long as they have anything extra to it, they can play with it and make it more, you know, delicious and delectable and fun and so on. I'm not an anthropologist, so I have no idea whether that's right or not. But certainly, if you just want to talk about our foodscape here in the U.S., foods that serve extra nutrient functions are part of the landscape.
So we all need food to survive. Not everyone has sufficient food. What kinds of questions can we ask ourselves about whether food is a fundamental human right, or access to food is a fundamental human right?
Well, the right to food is guaranteed in the UN Declaration of Human Rights from 1948. And that's something that every member state of the United Nations has ratified. So in principle, every nation should be obligated to guarantee the right to food. And that doesn't mean that you have the right to demand a sandwich from your local government official, but it just means that your government has to create the conditions that allow you to produce and consume freely, and would have the obligation to intervene during the case of crises or shortage to provide, you know, emergency relief. So, I mean, the idea of a right to food is not something that's really, you know, kind of wild and exotic. It's right there. You know, just it's an actual written right that's available in a document that anyone can find online. If you could take a step back and see where you'd make the argument rather than just treat it like a positive law, like just something that's a right because it's been agreed upon and ratified by UN member states. But if you accept the simple premise that we all have a right to life, and you think a little bit more broadly of what it means to actually enjoy those rights and exercise those rights, then it means you have a right not to just mere existence like a goldfish in a bowl, but there's things that you need in order to enjoy those rights, like freedom, like food in your tummy, like being free from illness, probably literacy, and a whole other host of conditions that are required in order to live freely.
We're speaking this hour with David M. Kaplan, director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas. They have a terrific website, by the way, if you want to read more about this, and it's easy to Google and find that online. He'll be speaking tonight to the UT Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology's lecture series. His talk is about the arguments for and against artificial ingredients in food. It's called What's Wrong with Artificial Ingredients? If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David M. Kaplan, director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas. He'll be speaking tonight at the University of Texas at Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology for their lecture series. His talk is entitled, What is Wrong with Artificial Ingredients in Food? If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Lisa in South Lake. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I've got a question about deprivation and religion. And it occurred to me, what did Anne Frank, it's been a long time since I've read her diary, and those Jews in hiding end up having to make decisions when they were deprived of food, what they would eat and what they wouldn't. Do we have any historical data on that that your guests would know about?
I don't know if this is something you've looked into, David.
It is not something I've looked into.
All right. Well, it was a good question, Lisa, but we can't get an answer for you today.
Sorry, I can't shed light on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Okay, so there are also questions about whether we have an obligation to care for our own bodies, and food plays into that. So are we somehow committing an immoral act if we pass up that nice kale salad and eat hot Cheetos for lunch?
Yes.
Because it's bad for us, or in the long run.
Or because we have obligations to ourselves, right? We have obligations to others, you know, minimally not to harm them, maximally to help others, to be kind to others, to render aid to others. You know, Kant calls it the duty of beneficence. It's not the kind of thing that you always have to do, but you have to do at least sometimes. And certainly you have to do it to others if you can rightfully expect others to do it to you, to render aid to you, to help you out when you need a flat tire fixed, or help you out when you need blood. So we have obligations, but we also have obligations to ourselves. We have obligations minimally just to protect and preserve ourselves, but also to better ourselves. I mean, that's what we say about someone who's let himself go,
mm-hmm.
right? I lose my job. I don't shave. I drink vodka and watch the Weather Channel all day and so on. And there's intuitively there's something wrong with that. You want that person to respect himself, to treat himself as if he is the kind of being that is deserving of dignity and humanity. So I think it might be a little bit strong to say that we, you know, rob ourselves of dignity when we eat Cheetos. But that is where that argument would go. And so part of eating well is, again, not just a matter of health and diet, but a matter of dignity and respecting oneself.
Is it robbing others of dignity to sell Cheetos, knowing that people will eat these and watch the Weather Channel and, you know, whatever? Is there something wrong with profiting from producing foods that are inherently unhealthful?
Probably. The food industry would say that they're just sort of putting it out there.
It's a choice.
It's a choice. That's right. It's just part of the buffet. And, you know, you can get the rice and the veggies, or you could go straight for the, you know, deep fried chicken wings or something like that. It's up to you. But I think you're right. I mean, it raises a real question about responsibility and even liability for one's products. So, You know, if you buy a ladder and it has 6 different bright yellow signs that say, you know, warning, proper use like so, don't step above here, and so on. Should junk food come with labels?
Hmm.
6 brightly colored labels warning about possible long-term risks and abuses and other such things. I mean, I think if you take this idea of liability and responsibility for one's, you know, consumer goods seriously, then I think that's the kind of questions you have to ask about foods that are known to be unhealthy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jonah in Dallas. Hello, Jonah.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I turned on my radio 90.1. First of all, I love 90.1.
Thank you.
And thank you for bringing this discussion about food. There is one thing I want to talk about, actually comment, is the value of the money that you spend to buy fast food. Let's say I spend $7 to buy a hamburger in the one of the common fast food restaurants, a hamburger, some fries, and probably a drink.
Mm-hmm.
When I spend that $7, I feel like I have taken $7 from my pocket and thrown it away.
Hmm.
Why? Because first of all, I'm from Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from a country called Kenya. And I happen to have a chance of traveling around the world. I've been to Cuba, Mexico. If you spend $7 on food in Cuba or Mexico, you feel like you have actually ate something. But a hamburger, some fries that cannot even add up to one big potato from Walmart, I feel like the value is not there.
Thank you so much for your call, Jonah. What do you think about that? There are questions as to whether is it wrong to overspend on food based on its nutritional contribution to our lives? Is that simply a choice that we're free to make if we have sufficient assets?
Sure. I don't see why not. I mean, if you have excess money, I mean, it's obviously your choice to spend it however you please on clothes, on movies, on whatever. Where I thought the caller was going was sort of the more typical line, which is that food in this country is enormously inexpensive,
mm-hmm.
especially things that are subsidized. So the big, you know, commodities and beef and poultry and so on. Whereas the healthier foods are not heavily subsidized, namely, you know, fruits and vegetables and so on. So it's very easy to eat unhealthfully on a budget and very difficult to make healthy choices on a budget. And that is a very serious question about political will and really about social justice. So it's basically public monies are going to support industries that ultimately, you know, erode the health and well-being of the very people who are supporting them. And so that is something that is a matter of, it's of grave importance.
It came up on this show just the other day that there are countries recognizing that arable land within their borders may be less plentiful as climate changes, and they're going to need to feed their own populations. They're sort of buying up land in other countries so that you might ultimately have a situation where the local population goes hungry while their arable land is used to feed another country. And I'm wondering for you, just in a general sense, as a philosopher of food, how important it is to have an awareness of food and food issues, not only within the United States, but around the planet.
Yeah, it's important for all of us. I know that question's kind of difficult. I didn't know where you were going with that, if you're talking about, you know, how climate change might potentially affect agricultural practices of different nations, and unfortunately that's sort of the mess we've gotten ourselves in. It's not only, it'll affect some nations for the better and some for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that arable land is going to cash crops for export rather than being used to feed a domestic population is also kind of tricky because, You know, most people aspire to more than just sustenance. They aspire to prosperity. And so, I mean, there's nothing really intrinsically wrong with growing a crop and then selling it for money rather than growing it and eating it. I mean, that's certainly the kind of thing that happens here, and it's perfectly reasonable for people elsewhere around the world to do that.
Before we let you go, you are talking tonight about artificial ingredients in food. Can you just give us just a little little idea of the kinds of issues that you'll be considering?
Yeah, it's the one of the philosophical itches that that I need scratched is sort of this difference between natural and artificial foods and kind of foods and drugs and chemicals. It becomes rather fluid, and it's hard to have a clear sense of where, you know, the food begins and the chemicals begin, or what kinds of processing are acceptable and what kind of processing is unacceptable. So, you know, chopping and freezing and salting is acceptable food processing, but, you know, genetic modification and irradiation and so on that makes us take pause. And so the intuition behind the paper is just to try to sort through the reasons that we might support or criticize foods that have a long list of chemical additives. So it's that sense that I think a lot of us have is when we look down at the ingredient list on the food we eat and feel like there's just something off, and that maybe as a rule of thumb we should eat foods that have fewer artificial ingredients than more, even if those ingredients are perfectly safe. So what I try to do is just sort of sort through the reasons that we could offer in support and defense of adding chemical additives to our foods, and also the kind of reasons we might offer to be suspicious and perhaps reject them.
David M. Kaplan is director of the Philosophy of Food Project at the University of North Texas. He'll be speaking tonight as part of the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology lecture series on artificial ingredients in food. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.